With that, I will call the final case that we have scheduled for oral argument this morning, case number A24-0430, In Re Appeal of Youssef. Good morning, counsel. I want to double check just as we start that everyone has gallery mode on and is able to see our time clock. Can all the counsel see the time clock?
I am actually not seeing gallery mode option yet. I just had a WebEx update.
Sue, do you have any? I was just going to ask if you had any suggestion.
Got it. Thank you.
So everyone can see the time clock. Just a reminder to all counsel, if you could please mute your microphones when you're not speaking to avoid the background noise, we would appreciate it. Each side will have 15 minutes for oral argument. As we briefly discussed, the respondents will be splitting their time. My understanding is that DHS is going to have 10 minutes and the county is reserving 5 minutes. Is that correct?
Correct from the department's perspective.
That's correct.
And then, counsel appellant, you will of course have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We do make an audio record, so if you could please identify yourself and who you represent prior to beginning your argument, we would very much appreciate it. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Jason Steck, Steck, and I represent the appellants, Caring for Adults and Kehinde Youssef. What would it look like if an agency decision was being made on grounds that are arbitrary and capricious? It's a term that we use all the time to say agencies' decisions can't be arbitrary and capricious, but it's merely described in the case law as something that reflects the agency's will rather than its judgment. But what would it look like in the facts? I'd submit that some of the best indications of an arbitrary and capricious decision-making process, two of them are both present in this case. First of all, there's confirmation bias, the idea that certain elements of evidence are viewed as dispositive if they indicate a predetermined conclusion, and others are dismissed in a case if it is doesn't match the predetermined conclusion. So when we see an agency treating same facts differently in different cases, it's an indication that there may be confirmation bias in play and that the agency may be twisting the facts to meet its predetermined conclusion. And secondly, when we see that there is an investigation process or an apparently neutral definition that is targeted on a specific community, then we start to have another indication of an arbitrary and capricious decision-making process. Those are both present in this case. This case is a case about an adult foster care license revocation. A adult foster care provider in Clay County was part of a generalized targeted enforcement campaign targeted against West African providers in Clay County in 2022 and 2023. And we know that it was targeted because we can see from the DHS's own licensing page that 100% of the adverse licensing actions against adult foster care providers since 2022 and 2023 were against West African providers, all of them. And when we look across the statewide, we see it going on in another county as well, in Olmsted. And when we combine looking at those cases, we see DHS applying a definition of the primary residence requirement for adult foster care providers differently across those cases, but always to gain the end, the predetermined end of a license revocation.
Mr. Steck, I appreciate the argument. I'm wondering how that fits in with our standard of review in this particular case, not knowing any of the facts in the other cases, And looking at the record here, what should guide our decision in this appeal?
What it should do in this case is cause this court to question whether or not the presumption of regularity in agency proceedings still applies. If it can be shown at a prima facie level that the agency's decision appears to be inconsistent across cases, given the published record that's available from those other cases, the administrative hearing orders from those cases, if it can be shown that there appears that the agency appears to be applying the same facts differently across cases, it should the court should ask the question whether the presumption of regularity still applies or whether the agency is conducting a campaign of license revocation that is inconsistent across cases and therefore no longer regular and is arbitrary and capricious.
Well, did you pr oh, go ahead, Judge Warke.
Mr. Stack, on that level, you've argued that this is West that this is a minority attack, but in that regard, you're arguing that it's the county licensor or the DHS because you've brought up another county that is in fact embarking on this discrimination. How does that comport with our review of an ALJ or a decision maker review versus something that is outside of the scope of the review?
If I understand the question right, it's how do we review in one case what's going on in comparison with other cases? And what I'm,
We're
did I?
looking at a decision by ALJs. That's our focus of review. And I think what you want us to do is go beyond that, and you're making a broad claim of bias as it relates to DHS as a whole.
Well, to some extent, the court's concern is absolutely right. And in this case, the appellants attempted to develop the record more sufficiently for the court to consider that exact question and was prevented from doing so at the administrative level. The door was slammed shut really hard on the notion that they could present any evidence of bias coming from either the county or the state. And let's be
How
clear.
does your bias argument apply here, where I believe the parties agree? I mean, the decision here turned on whether the facility was Mr. Yusuf's primary residence. I see the parties all agreeing on what that definition, I mean, the statute doesn't define it in the context of this particular statute, but I think you agree, the parties agree that primary residence is the principal dwelling or place where a person lives. If
Yes.
I'm right about that, then doesn't our review just turn on whether there evidence was presented that supports the ALJs and ultimately the commissioner's factual and legal determinations that that standard was met here, that this in fact wasn't his primary residence?
It goes to the definite, it goes to the question, the word principle within that definition, right? Is that the department has, I don't want to say promulgated because that's exactly what they haven't done, but what they've done is they've created a list of factors since the Casterton case in 2021 that is the department's list of factors of things that they're telling their licensing people that they should consider. Now, how the department treats that list of factors is something that this court needs to review, because what's happening here is that the department.
Counsel, it's sorry for interrupting, but this is an appeal under 14.69, correct?
Yes.
So you can bring an argument that something is that the agency has made a legally erroneous decision, and you can also make an argument that even if the decision wasn't legally erroneous, that the agency acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner under one. Or 1469 F, even if there isn't a legal problem, right? And as I understand both your bias argument and your that it's not being applied fairly, that those would fall under the category of F, regardless of your arguments with respect to the interpretation of the word primary residence.
Yes, we're presenting both arguments here, Your Honor. The issue here is that, and I'm focusing for the oral argument right now at the beginning, I was focusing on the second. But the first we have an argument for as well, and that is that the agency, in this list of factors that they developed since Casterton, has created a de facto definition. Now the agency says, well, no, it's just a list of factors. It's just things to consider. But when the court looks at how it's actually treated, that's not how it comes out. The agency does not investigate the entire list of factors and attempt to find what the base of evidence is before it determines whether or not it has a preponderance. What it does—
Counsel, did you challenge the validity of this guidance document before the ALJ?
Yes. My recollection is that the prior counsel did challenge the validity of the department's list of factors at the ALJ level. And I'd have to go back and check.
And maybe you could find that for me for your rebuttal time. Because when I look at the way the argument was framed, it had more to do with the application than it did with it being improper to look at the guidance document, or and I just wasn't able to find the argument that you're making here, which is the guidance document is actually an illegal, unpromulgated rule that can't be applied. And so it would be helpful to me if you could point to me where in the record those arguments were made to the ALJ, because I was not able to find it.
I perhaps misunderstood the question or misspoke there. No, they did not argue directly that it was an unpromulgated rule. And the department is correct that there is a procedure set aside for that. But that is a pre-enforcement procedure. In Minnesota Statute 14.381, it allows for any person to attack what may be an unpromulgated rule pre-enforcement. What we're dealing with here, though, is what the point when the department is making, we're already at an enforcement level. So it's not something that they could raise to the ALJ there. It's not an opportunity for the ALJ to say, yes, it's an
legal support. Do you have that you could not challenge that a rule is illegal in an enforcement action? And if it's true that you can't, then how could you bring it up on appeal? Why can't you raise that with the ALJ that there's an illegal and promulgated rule that can't be applied to your client at the agency level? I mean, I guess I don't understand why it could be raised here if it couldn't be raised in front of the ALJ.
Because it still constitutes an error of law, which would be an error by the ALJ that this court can review, the question of whether or not that is a definition and whether or not it is an unpromulgated rule. At the end of the day, the question is whether or not the department has presented reasonable cause and ultimately a preponderance of evidence, whether that the license holder did not maintain the AFC facility as their primary or principal residence.
And ultimately on this record, because I think the parties agree as to what that definition is, and I know there's factors identified, but why is this record inadequate to support the ALJ's determination that this facility was not, in fact, the relator's or Mr. Yusuf's primary residence?
Because the department misrepresented what its list of factors was, and that the ALJ misapplied what those list of factors was.
But my question has to do with the record, the facts right now, because again, let's just assume right now that there's no misrepresentation of what the standard is, because in fact, that's what the ALJ is deciding, right? Whether primary residence is proven or not. And what is it on this record that should persuade us that the evidence was not sufficient to sustain the ALJ's factual determinations?
Quite bluntly, because we have no indication that Mr. Yusuf lived anywhere other than at the AFC facility. What we have is the ALJ crediting the department's inferences based upon the mere fact that they found his name on the buzz-in box at another apartment. That doesn't mean somebody lives there. They didn't go into the apartment. They didn't check to see if he had a bedroom there. They didn't interview anybody to determine whether or not he actually lived there or was even ever seen there. They simply drew an assumption and then said, we're done. That's the whole problem with how the department has been treating these cases.
But the ALJ evaluated the sufficiency of that evidence, right? I mean, we can't do that as an appellate court. I'm unsure as to what we could do And that's why I'm asking you, what is the compelling or what evidence is lacking that makes the ALJ's findings of fact, or makes the record facts insufficient?
The problem is that the ALJ is relying on the testimony of the department's witnesses to put meat on the bones of what it means by the term principal. And it is not allowing those to be questioned. In other words, it's allowing the department to detail a statement of what is important. So, for example, it'll say that the ALJ here found that the department had a made a valid inference that it must have somebody that's because Mr. Youssef had his name on another residence, that was sufficient to rebut the assumption that he didn't live there, or he didn't live at the AFC residence. But if he's at the residence, if that's all it takes, it's simply impossible for any appellant anywhere to ever meet their burden on the second part, because all the department has to say is, well, in this case, we consider this factor to be important, the fact that he had another residence someplace else. And we don't consider it a factor, for example, that his driver's license is important. And then in another case, they'll argue, well, we don't consider the statements of people made at the scene to be important. We only consider where they registered their driver's license to be important. They're telling the ALJs, and the ALJs are relying on the notion that the whatever the department finds to be the most important pieces of its definition, those are the ones that should be weighed accordingly. In other words, the department admits, the ALJ is essentially assigning out to the department the weighing of the evidence as well as the presumption of regularity.
Which is why I don't understand your brief as raising a sufficiency challenge under 14.69E. I see you as raising an arbitrary and capricious argument under 169F, right? It's not. Am I wrong about that? I know the state makes a pretty long argument with regard to sufficiency, but I didn't understand your brief as raising a sufficiency challenge.
I would say we're doing both. And the issue is that at the point that a decision to not only target a facility, but then apply inconsistent and conflicting standards to this facility, my time's up. At the point that those things happen, I think arbitrary and capriciousness enters the is the appropriate standard.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for DHS, you have 10 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Attorney General Drew Bredesen, representing respondent, the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Relator wants the court's attention elsewhere, but there is no real dispute of the facts or the law in this case. The Minnesota legislature determined that for family adult foster care, the licensed home must be the primary residence of the license holder. The fact record below showed good reason for DHS to determine that this licensed home was not relator's primary residence, including that lack of personal items in the home, resident statement that the relator was not there most nights, tax records showing that the home was the property of and homestead of Mr. Hamed. There's no real dispute of the substantial evidence here, and no real dispute that primary residence is unambiguous, and no real dispute that the licensed home here was not relator's primary residence.
You don't disagree that under 14.69, you can separately challenge a decision as being arbitrary and capricious, even if it is supported by substantial evidence. I mean, the Supreme Court has said so as recently as the Polymet case in 2013, that arbitrary and capriciousness is separate from substantial evidence.
I don't dispute that. And so moving into the actual legal arguments here, DHS was correct to revoke. DHS did not act arbitrarily or capriciously and committed no error of law in determining primary residence. It's undisputed that the legislature authorizes revocation where the licensed home is not the license holder's primary residence. So revocation for that reason is explicitly authorized. Primary residence is not defined by statute, but it is unambiguous in its plain meaning, showing that that means principal, main, chief, the place where the license holder usually lives and sleeps. Relator does not suggest any alternative definition here, which could lead to some other outcome in this case. difficult to see another definition that could, especially based on these facts below. And so there is no legal error in applying that term primary residence. DHS applying the term.
I do think that the argument is that the agency in developing this list of factors without going through any rulemaking has maybe expanded the definition beyond a plain language interpretation, and that that is what should have gone through a Chapter 14 rulemaking process. Is it your position that that argument was made in front of the ALJ with regard to the guidance document?
No, it is not. The ALJ did not receive an argument about the validity of that document below.
And do you have a position with respect to whether you could, in an enforcement challenge the validity of an unpromulgated rule, or is it the DHS's position you would have to do that through a Section 381 action?
The Section 381 action is the primary way to make that challenge. To the extent that Relator is arguing that DHS's position is arbitrary or capricious, we want to address that on the merits as much as possible. And that's why, in this case, we want to make clear that DHS applying the term primary does not create any unpromulgated rule. It is simply applying the plain language of the statute and applying it on a case-by-case basis. There's no reliance on an unpromulgated rule. What DHS did here is to give notice, give information to a lot of interested parties about potential factors to consider. This is guidance. This is the whole point here was to let people know these are things that we may be looking at in order to make that decision. And looking at...
When I was looking at this guidance, it actually looks like it's something that maybe gets used more often on the front end in evaluating whether you would qualify. Could you give a little context for when this document is used by the agency?
Sure. My understanding of the document is that it was sent out to the license holders throughout the county, in this case, specifically to inform them of, you know, the importance of maintaining primary residence according to statute at the licensed home. I believe that that went to, it was used on both the front end and the back end in terms of being an informational document that these are factors to consider. But again, in these cases, the point here is that they're giving factors to consider. These are not determinative outcomes. This is gathering information. This is making a judgment. This is not imposing will when DHS gathers evidence, reaches a conclusion based on the evidence gathered on sufficient evidence and evidence that is substantial in the record below. And DHS applying a definition, an interpretation that is consistent with the plain meaning of statute does not create a rule that does not expand the meaning of statute. Again, it's very, DHS is not seeing what Relator's argument is to the extent that it's trying to say that DHS expanded beyond that meaning of primary residence. I don't see an extra edge that is given by adding adjectives and sources of information as to ways that facts can be gathered and evidence to consider.
Now,
so DHS,
just a point of clarification, I may have made my notes wrong. This August 1st, 2021 memo, I'm looking at it, it says it went to all county adult foster care licensing staff. Are you suggesting it also went to license holders, or did I get that wrong?
The letter does correctly state who it went to.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes. And so that letter was available to county licensing staff due to the delegated licensing structure in Minnesota. They are both involved on both ends of both issuing and monitoring, and then if necessary, sanctions on the back end. Continuing to the legal argument here, DHS is permitted to advocate for its interpretation. That is also not rulemaking. And there is no reliance on a rule. DHS is specifically conducting a case-by-case analysis and analyzing relevant facts. that is simply not rulemaking. And so then DHS's application here is consistent with its approach in other cases. Again, the factors are being used on a case-by-case basis. None of them is necessarily determinative. DHS is trying to find out where a person usually lives and sleeps. And that is the position that I believe Relator is advocating for in his brief. So DHS inconsistently applying a case-by-case analysis is considering things like where the person's bedroom is, where are their personal belongings, where are their furnishings, what do the facts from the license holder say about where they usually live? That's what DHS did here. And again, the facts below gave good reason and substantial evidence for DHS to revoke. Residents said that the relator wasn't there most nights. He had no personal items in the bedroom, toiletries in the bathroom, registered his vehicle to a different address, and Mr. Hamed owned the property and claimed it as his homestead. There is simply no application error here. There is no expansion beyond statute. DHS did what the statute expects of it, and what it sounds like Relator is asking for is to gather facts to analyze and determine whether or not the licensed home is in fact his primary residence, and found here for good reason that it was not.
I do have one question, and your time is running out. With respect to, I think the case law is pretty clear that one way to show arbitrary and capricious conduct is to show bias on behalf of the agency. Was it improper for the ALJ to allow the relator to elicit the testimony it seemed that they were attempting to elicit regarding the bias issue, since evaluating the arbitrary and capriciousness of the decision is a separate factor from substantial evidence?
Your Honor, if I understand your question, their bias was not argued in closings or exceptions briefing to the commissioner, so it was waived.
But you don't disagree that the counsel for appellant below attempted to ask some questions of one of the witnesses regarding bias, and that ALJ, I mean, did sort of say that's not a subject matter that I'm interested in. Was it improper for the ALJ to limit the evidence in that way when they're, you know, when arbitrariness and capriciousness is a factor under 14.69?
It was not an error. It was not arbitrary or capricious. Just being conscious of time here, I'd like to try and complete the answer. There
Feel
was
free to
it
respond.
Was. Appreciate it. The ALJ was appropriately excluding hearsay evidence. Non-reliable hearsay is properly excluded, for one thing. And in addition to that, there is no evidence that suggested bias that was either made as a proof, as an offer of proof, or actually elicited. The most that was pointed to was Ms. Davenport asking investigative questions. Where were you? Why were you gone during the hours that you'd be expected to be in this facility? The bias argument here further simply doesn't even challenge this revocation was appropriate. It's an argument that other licenses should also be revoked instead of facing some other outcome. So there's no showing of bias from the county. There's no showing of bias on a broader level. The ALJ was appropriate to exclude further evidence that was irrelevant and wouldn't tend to prove bias regardless. And there is no bias in the record that impacts the analysis or outcome. Unless there's further questions, DHS respectfully requests that the court affirm the revocation in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Stock, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Katie Stock, and I represent the appellee in the Department of Human Services.
Clarification before you get going. Mr. Bredesen, in response to a question, said that the notice provisions, the residency provisions, were given to the DHS staff. Was a similar notice given to the providers, the license holders?
Yes, I believe so. There was some reference to letters going out to the license holders in January of 2022. In the interest of time, I just would like to direct the court's attention to the findings of fact, conclusions of law, recommendation, and order, and the memorandum issued by the administrative law judge in this case that was then affirmed by the commissioner, specifically in the memorandum portion beginning at page 12 There is reference to credibility and reliability of the witnesses in this case in not one but three paragraphs throughout this memorandum. The court has considered the credibility and reliability of the witnesses and simply found appellant and his witnesses not to be credible. Specifically under paragraph 2 on page 12, the ALJ writes, appellant's credibility came into question when he testified that Mr. Hamed is only a neighbor who had no financial or business interest in his foster care business or the outcome of this licensing action. Neither appellant nor Mr. Hamed volunteered relevant information that Mr. Hamed purchased the 1318 32nd Street Circle in November of 2022, the address of the facility, and that appellant pays Mr. Hamed rent. Rather, appellant provided the rental agreement he signed with the previous owner of 1318 32nd Street Circle. Appellant acknowledged Mr. Hamed's ownership of the property only after the department presented rebuttal testimony showing Mr. Hamed's ownership. On page 13, there is reference to the appellant responded to the negative in the negative when he was asked if live stream cameras were used for remote supervision of the facility, and the court found this not to be credible, specifically saying, but the response is not credible, particularly in light of the corporate home nature of the instructional signs, appellant's absence and evolving explanations of his whereabouts during hours a license holder would typically be home, and the capacity with which appellant described his relationship with Mr. Hamed. After 2 days of hearing in this case, there was a subsequent motion filed again on page 14 of the memorandum. The ALJ addresses the credibility issue. Post-hearing date, appellant requested to correct an inaccuracy and supplement the record, arguing that because English is not his primary language, that he did not understand questions with respect to Mr. Hamed's ownership or financial interest in the outcome of this proceeding. But the court found that the appellant was and this is directly from page 14, he was able to testify in English, declined the use of an interpreter, and did not ask for clarification or explanation of any questions presented to him. He provided his lease agreement, but did not provide additional evidence reflective of the current lease with Mr. Hamed, nor did Mr. Hamed testify about his ownership of 1318 32nd Street Circle. Appellant had an obligation to present this evidence in a forthright manner and chose not to do so. Appellant's request is not to correct in inaccuracy, but rather a request to change his testimony after the truth was exposed. This tells us that the ALJ did consider all of the evidence and found Mr. Yusuf and his witnesses to not be credible. Additionally, she did consider Mr. Steck's argument that two unannounced home visits to the home would be insufficient to prove whether this facility is the appellant's primary residence or not. And specifically on page 12, again, she writes, by itself, she agrees that the two unannounced visits would not be sufficient. However, when viewed in the full context of the facts, the department has met its burden to demonstrate reasonable cause for the license revocation, and then goes on to explain how the department met its burden. So again, I just want to reiterate that the ALJ did properly consider all of the evidence. There is substantial evidence to support the factual findings, and we can see that from the written memorandum in this case, and I would ask this court to affirm the commissioner's amended order of license revocation. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for relator, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Larson. In answer to the court's previous question to me about where the factors list is discussed, it's in the transcript. It's referring to Exhibit 105. That's apparently where the factors are laid out, and it's a transcript starting at page 104, and it goes on for many pages afterward. I wasn't able to get to the point of identifying where the end point is, but trial counsel in this case extensively questioned the department's witness on this document and its application of it. And it's interesting that the department here relies heavily on this credibility argument. saying, well, that a judge made credibility findings and that's enough. But that's exactly what the appellant was not allowed to present when the door was closed on presenting any evidence of biased enforcement. Now, Mr. Bredesen argues that, hey, it doesn't matter. That just maybe means some other people should be also targeted for revocation. But that's not the limit of the problem. It's not just saying, hey, there might be some other people in violation also. But it's about how these cases are being investigated and how these license revocations are being imposed. The question is not only whether or not only certain people are being investigated, which they are, but also how does the apartment go about applying its factors? For example, in this case, it says that its factors list things like the appellant's driver's license as being an important factor to look at. But when the appellant presented his driver's license showing the AFC facility as his residence, the department not only failed to include that in their own investigation, they didn't look into it. They only looked until they could find something that violated something on their list so they could go straight to revocation. But they immediately poo-pooed that and said, no, no, it doesn't matter because we've got this other thing. That list.
Well, he also got a new driver's license after the after he met with one of the licensing inspectors, right? I mean, wasn't there a reason to be somewhat suspect of that?
Well, there would be if he had been told in advance that he needed to have his driver's license be the AFC facility. And that's something else I wanted to clear up, because there's been some lack of clarity from the department about exactly who was told what and when. There are two letters in 2021 from the department that went out to licensing officials in the counties telling them what the department's list of factors were. As far as I'm aware, those were not provided to the individual providers until a 2023 letter, which is well after this case took place here. There was a 2023 letter from the department to the providers directly. But until that point, there's no evidence that I'm aware of in the record, this case or any other, that indicates that the license holders were ever put on notice that any of these factors would be drawn as inferences against them as having living as where they're living. So that kind of highlights what kind of a gotcha game the department's been playing here. They announce a list of factors to their license holders, send out the license holders to do an investigation, and as was the case here, tell the investigators to specifically stop investigating as soon as they find a single violation of a factor, so that they don't have to find compliance on all the other factors and can then say, we've got enough to go to revocation. That process cannot be said to be reasonable, to be either reasonable cause or a preponderance of the evidence. What it is a gotcha game. We announce a list of factors to our licensing investigators only, send them out to use it as a checklist. As soon as they find a violation, we issue a revocation order. We amend it later to add stuff if we find more stuff. But we definitely don't go looking for anything that might indicate that the license holder actually does live there. And when they do show that evidence, when the license holder comes to court and say, here's our stuff from your own list of factors that says I live there, they then say, you shouldn't pay any attention to that because this is the only thing that's important in this case. The one consistent fact here is that the department always finds whatever factor it used to say that the revocation was justified, that's the only one that's important. And they rely on this court's reluctance to look at comparisons to other cases to determine whether it might be arbitrary and capricious because they're treating it differently in different cases. That's what we're asking this court to do, to take a look at the department's pattern here from the publicly available evidence and determine whether the department is acting arbitrarily and capriciously by applying its own list of factors selectively so as to get to a predetermined conclusion that's a reflection of the agency's will, not its judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all the counsel in this case. This case has been submitted and we will issue a decision in the time prescribed by statute. That concludes our oral argument calendar this morning. And with that, we are adjourned.